and welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. My name is Brandon J. Fedor, and I'm your host. This week, I spoke to Jay Hillis Miller about his recent book, The Conflagration of Community, Fiction Before and After Auschwitz, put out by the University of Chicago Press. The book tackles a lot of issues, central of which is whether or not fiction can bear witness to the Holocaust. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I think you will as well. Today I'm talking with Jay Hillis Miller about his new book, The Conflagration of Community, Fiction Before and After Auschwitz. Dr. Miller, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
If you could just first say a little bit about yourself, about your career, that would be great.
Well, I was born in Newport News, Virginia, and my parents were both from Virginia, were Virginians. Children in both cases of farmers in Virginia, the first generation that have gone, of both either family that have gone to college. So that's a part of American history. The people who went to college in the early 20th century from families that had never gone to college before. But I grew up mostly in the North. In upstate New York, my father was a college and university administrator, first president of a little Baptist college called Cuca College in the on Cuca Lake, one of the Finger Lakes in upstate New York. And then he was associate commissioner for higher and professional education for the state of New York and Albany. And then he was president of the University of Florida. So I went to grade school, actually, in a one-room school, 20 students for sixth grade. One of the best teachers I had, her name was Mrs. Ainsley. She was a wonderful, wonderful teacher. And by the way, we shamelessly said the Lord's Prayer every morning. Nobody worried about that in those days. Then I went to high school from there by bus to a place called Penyan, New York, and then to high school in Delmar, New York, which is where we lived when my father was in Albany. I went to Oberlin College, where I majored in English, after having started as a physics major. In the middle of my sophomore year, I decided I was really interested in literature. And I can still remember the way in which my science training was transferred to the study of literature. I found the use of language in poetry and literature very peculiar. And the poem that I remember connecting with that was Tennyson's, a famous short poem by Tennyson called Tears, Idle Tears. And it goes, "Tears, idle tears, I know not what they mean. Tears from the depth of some divine despair gather in the heart and rise to the eyes and thinking of the days that are no more." And I thought that was really peculiar. What does he mean, idle tears? And what does he mean that they rise from the depths of some divine despair, et cetera, et cetera? So I had a lot of questions which were, in a way, derived from my training as a scientist where you're supposed to explain things. And then I went to, by the way, I got tremendous support from both my wife-to-be, Dorothy, and from my father in making this big career change from physics to English. Then I went to Harvard for graduate school, where I wrote a dissertation under a Renaissance scholar named Douglas Bush. The dissertation was on Dickens, who was one of the early fascinations in literature for me, so I stuck to my wish to write a dissertation on Dickens. I taught for a year at Williams College and then went for 19 wonderful years at Johns Hopkins in the English department there in the days when people didn't worry so much about the future of literary study. That was from 1953 to 1972. In 1972, I moved to Yale in the English department there, where eventually I got a joint appointment in comparative literature. And it was there that I met the people that are associated with the so-called Yale School, the Yale Mafia, Harold Bloom and Jeffrey Hartman and Paul Dineen, and Derrida, who Jacques Derrida, who came every year to give seminars, as he'd come at Hopkins every third year. So I had known Derrida for a long time. We had a 40-year friendship.
Wow.
So my first year was, first book was on Dickens, very different from the dissertation. The dissertation was steeped in Kenneth Burke, and it was written in a way against the Harvard English Department ethos, you might say. They didn't care much for literary theory, so the theory that I was already doing was done clandestinely, you might say, or on my own. There were no courses in theory in those days, and it happened that my dissertation director, Bush, really detested Kenneth Burke. Why? Well, the reason he gave was that Burke uses the editorial we. He says, now we will show. And Bush didn't like that. The real reason was that he was a theorist. So I submitted this enormous dissertation, literally enormous, 800 pages or something, called The Symbolic Imagery of Charles Dickens. Bush read it over one weekend, well, claimed to have read it, and he had two comments. One, he said, I accept the dissertation. Secondly, he said, I suggest that sometimes you use that rather than which. That was the sum total of his comment. And I've been trying ever since to, I know the rule, it's restrictive, non-restrictive for which and that, but I don't quite know how to apply it. So now I just don't use which, I always use that. And that in general works. I mean, Bush was right, I used too many witches. Bush must have somehow liked my work because he recommended me with one other person for the job at Hopkins, which was a wonderful assistant professorship. I was the first person, it's hard to believe, the first person in the English department at Hopkins in 19th century literature. Up until then, it sort of stopped with the Romantics. The assumption was that all gentlemen had read Victorian literature on their own. After I got to... I was still at Hopkins, I began writing the series of books that are readings of the complete work of various authors, primarily poets. At that time, I was deeply under the influence of Georges Poulet and the so-called Geneva School of Consciousness, so I wanted to write long essays that gathered together thematically things from all the work by a given author, Gerard Manley Hopkins, let's say, or Emily Bronte, or Browning. So I'm one of the relatively few people who's read Browning from one end to the other, every poem he wrote, which is a lot of poems. Then when I met Derrida and heard him at the famous Hopkins conference on structuralism in 1966, I began reading Derrida's stuff. I changed and essentially went back to the interest in language that had been my concern at the beginning. When I moved to Yale, I went on working, writing more books, but books that were more in the direction of what's now often called a deconstruction, but often involving narrative theory and so on. So the Consecration of Community is the end of a long series of books which really have as their center the attempt to account for literary works. I don't believe in the independent value of literary theory. Literary theory is useful only as a handmaiden to actually interpreting works of literature. I find theory fascinating, but it's secondary to my interest in actual literary works, and that has remained with me still. So that's a brief account of my career after I went to Irvine, which occurred in 1986. I had more time. One of my reasons for going, leaving main professorship at Yale, where I'd been treated very well and where I had those wonderful colleagues and really wonderful students, both graduate and undergraduate. The undergraduates at Yale are amazing, very gifted and wonderful, wonderful to teach. That's really what I most missed when I went to Irvine, where I taught only graduate courses, but I had a little more time to finish some books that I'd started at Yale and had not yet quite finished, that were why, because Yale really makes wonderfully attractive demands on you. If an undergraduate comes in and says, would you do a directed reading for me this term, it's not only that you're supposed to say yes, but you want to say yes because you know it will be interesting. For example, I remember one gifted student right at the end of my time at Yale who was a child actress from Wales who'd been sent to Yale to do her undergraduate work with the assumption that she would go back to England and continue her career as an actress. What happened at Yale was that she got interested in literature, especially Thomas Hardy, for some reason. So we used to have conversations about what she should do, and I told her she should do what her heart really told her to do, which was to give up acting and go to graduate school in English, and she did do that. She went to Yale, and then she moved back to England and got her PhD at Cambridge, and she's now a glorious professor at the Royal Holloway College in London. So it's that kind of person that you often met at Yale. One of my graduate students was someone you may have heard of, Eve Sedgwick. I don't know why she asked me to direct her dissertation. She'd been in courses of mine, maybe because she knew I wouldn't give her any trouble. But it was hard to predict from the work she was doing there that she would be one of the great inventors of queer theory. But she wrote a brilliant dissertation which was published, on Gothic novels. And she was so gifted a writer, the chapters would come in and I would say, thank you, Eve. I look forward to seeing the next chapter. I mean, I didn't do any directing, but she was a PhD of mine and a wonderfully nice person. And I could list a lot of other Yale PhDs that have had wonderful careers. Peter Sachs, for example, went to Hopkins and then to Harvard, where he's a professor. So the graduate students at Yale were also wonderful, fun to teach. I said that my interest is in interpreting works of literature. I should add that another side of my vocation is for teaching. I really have always loved to teach. All of my books, including the Confederation of Community, have come out of teaching. I mean, I need the teaching in order to try things out. The substitute for that now is the lecturing that I do here and there around the world. I don't know until I've tried it out on some audience whether some idea I have is going to fly or not. So teaching and writing have always been very closely related for me. And that's why I spent a lot of time in various ways doing administration. I was chair of the English department at Hopkins and then at Yale and So I made a deal at Irvine that I wasn't supposed to be an administrator there. I was chair of the department for acting chair for a quarter while the actual chair was on leave. But I never really enjoyed that as much as teaching. It's important, that kind of departmental administration. But for me, more important is to teach and write, and the administration gets in the way of that. Got to go to the office. And I remember when I got to the end of my, I think, 3 years at Yale as chair of the department, I was in California in the summer for the School of Criticism and Theory, and I went down to the beach at what I thought was midnight, in which would be the moment when July 1 came and I was no longer chair, and threw my hat in the air. Wonderful, I'm free. Unfortunately, I'd forgotten the three-hour time shift. So I still had another 3 hours. I think it's the other way around. I'd already ceased 3 hours earlier to be chair. But I immensely enjoyed my time at the University of California at Irvine, partly because it was a new place just organizing itself, partly because it was a place where theory, unlike Yale, or Harvard, or indeed, it was more institutionalized at Hopkins, but it certainly wasn't at either at Yale. At Irvine, it was. There was the School of Criticism and Theory was started there. There was a graduate critical theory emphasis, which still exists, which I still go back once a year to give seminars in. This was Mary Krieger, a professor there, who wanted to have theory something that was normally taught in university, both undergraduate and graduate courses in literature departments. Now that would be commonplace, but at the time Krieger started doing it, it was unusual. So he's a great innovator, and I had wonderful colleagues in theory there, not only Derrida, but Wolfgang Iser and Jean-François Lyotard, and now more recently Ballet Barre. So there's been a long series of, and Gayatri Spivak, who was teaching there more or less after I left or retired. And the graduate students at Irvine are very good. I had great fun teaching them. And I was interested to go to California for two reasons. Several reasons. It was overdetermined. One of the reasons was that I knew I would have more time for my own writing if I went there than I had had at Yale. And secondly, I think of California as, for better or for worse, the future of the United States, and I wanted to find out what it was like. And I mean specific things like that. The multitude of languages that are spoken in California, and now it's more commonplace in the United States, but it was the norm already, that mixture of different races and ethnic backgrounds. And I'd never taught in a public university. The University of California is probably the greatest, if you take the whole 10-campus thing together, probably the greatest public university in the world. And it was interesting, measuring it by how many Nobel Prize winners they have, et cetera. And I was interested to see what it would be like to teach in such a place. One of the surprises I found University of California was that the different campuses really are related to one another. For example, I had a student from India, graduate student, who decided she wanted to do work that involved Sanskrit. Irvine didn't have any Sanskrit, so she went up to Berkeley, remaining a graduate student at Irvine, studied Sanskrit, and wrote a dissertation that I directed, but that had as one of the members of the committee somebody from Berkeley. And that's easy to do in that system. Derrida's yearly 5 weeks of seminars were attended by people from UCLA and Riverside and San Diego. So it was a sort of gathering of people interested in Derrida's work. And that surprised me, because I thought of those universities were probably going to be sort of segregated from one another. So that's my life story.
Well, you mentioned...
Oh, you wanted me to say something about other interests.
If you'd like to.
Small boat sailing. I have here in Maine now my 18.5-foot Cape Dory Typhoon, which I sailed in last week, and I'm afraid that there isn't time this week. I try in the summer to go sailing once a week. I much enjoy camping and hiking. So I've climbed the Mount Katahdin, which is our highest mountain here, but that's a mere 5,000 feet. I say mere because in California, where I did some camping with my oldest daughter, you sort of park the car at 7,500 feet or 8,000 feet and go on up from there. But I've climbed Katahdin once with my son Matthew and once with my daughter Robin and her daughter. So there were three generations of us on the top of Mount Katahdin. Mm-hmm. So I was, it's a steep, rocky climb, not all that easy. I doubt now at the age of 84 whether I would be able to make it. This is only 5 years ago, I think, that last climb, roughly. And I'm very proud of Robin, who did the Appalachian Trail 2 or 3 years ago.
Wow.
2,300 miles, starting sort of late. She finished Mount Katahdin as the north end of it on Labor Day, and I went up and picked her up. And I met her. I walked up the trail a little to meet her because I knew she was there on the summit and was coming down be picked up in the car, and she was actually running down the trail. So she's at this very moment doing a very demanding hike called the Colorado Trail, where you start somewhat outside Denver, and which is, much of it is at 12,000 feet. She sent a photo of Kokomo Pass, which is 12,000 feet, and that's not months and months and months. She finishes, it's about a month, doing 15, 20 miles a day, day after day after day. So she's a serious hiker.
Okay, well, getting back to the book, you mentioned how it's sort of, it kind of concludes a lot of your work over the past couple of decades. And I'm wondering if you could, you talk about in the introduction about how the book is sort of a coming of to terms for you.
Yep.
And I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate on that, because in a lot of ways, I mean, the book is about the Holocaust, but it's very sort of rooted in the present day. You talk a lot about the Bush administration, Guantanamo Bay, Abu Ghraib. Yep. And I think there is a real sense of urgency in your book. And I'm just wondering if maybe to start with, you could kind of describe your project in the
right.
book.
Right. Well, the first thing to say is that I never would have done it if I had not been involved with a research group directed by my good friend Jakob Lothe. It's J-A-K-O-B-L-O-T-H-E at the University of Oslo. You may have noticed the book is dedicated to him.
Mm-hmm.
He had research money over a two-year period and invited me to be part of a group that was a considerable number of them were from different Norwegian universities, but his co-directors were James Phelan from Ohio State University, who's a narratologist, and Susan Suleiman from Harvard, who is a specialist on Holocaust literature. So I had never dared to think about working on Holocaust literature. I'd also not gone back seriously to Kafka, though I read Kafka when I was a graduate student or before. I was always fascinated by Kafka, but he's not exactly in my field. And the Toni Morrison part was a result, again, of a kind of accident that I sort of felt I should read that book, because I was beginning to read recent postmodern American fiction and European, which is not in any way my field. So, like most of my books, it was a kind of accident. And the fact that I chose primarily Imre Kertész as my example of a Holocaust novel is a result of my really naively asking Phelan and Lotte, and especially Suleiman, which Holocaust novel should I read? And they said, read Kertész's Fatelessness. She's herself, if I'm not mistaken, originally Hungarian. So that explains the genesis of the book. It doesn't exactly explain what happened when I started writing it. It has a number of different motives or threads. The first one would be to say that, like all of my other books, the major thing I wanted to do was to figure out what's going on in those three Kafka novels and the four novels about the Shoah, with most attention on Fatelessness, on Kertész, and in Beloved. I wanted to write essays about those novels in which I tried to account for them. So I'm still doing what I did right at the beginning when I shifted from physics. On the other hand, as in most of my books, there were some, you might say, some organizing themes, or you might even say theoretical issues, that come together in this book, and I can name them. One is the question of community, communities in literature. What is a community? How would you know when you had one? What are the varieties of community? Is community always a good thing? What are the theories of community that one would find when you started studying that? And I was, there's a lot of other unpublished stuff that talks about communities in literature in Conrad and Anthony Trollope and Pynchon and other authors that eventually will be published. So the first chapter of this book sets Jean-Luc Nancy against Wallace Stevens, and with some Heidegger thrown in, trying to figure out just what there is to think or say about community. But in the course of that, I asked myself, what's happened to community? Is Deer Isle a community, where so many of the people here all went to the same high school, go to the same churches and so on? It looks like an ideal community, but Deer Isle is also full of people, as they say, from away, like me, who were either summer people originally, or moved here, retired here, and so on. And one measure of this would be to say that when my wife, who used to go to a slightly different part of Maine as a child, when she was a child, she said it took 2 weeks before she could understand anybody because the Maine accent was so strong. It's more or less disappeared. Why? Because everybody watches television and listens to the radio, and it's gradually broken down, that community insularity. So that first, that's one of the things that I keep coming back to, for example, in the chapter on Kafka's The Castle, or indeed in the Fatelessness chapter, or the Morrison Beloved chapter. So that's a topic with a way of asking questions about these novels that would orient what I had to say about them. But then there's another theme that arose out of the work on Holocaust novels that I did in collaboration with my... We used to have meetings there, and we actually had a meeting with Kertész in Berlin, a very interesting one. He's a really interesting guy, which he answered questions. I refer to some of those questions in the book once or twice. But the question that seemed to me really important for the Holocaust novel section of the novel, of the book, is whether a work of fiction as a novel that is not, does not claim to be historically accurate, whether it can be valid testimony to the Holocaust. And that's a serious question. Elie Wiesel says, it's one of my epigraphs, it's either not a novel or it's not about Auschwitz. In other words, he denies the possibility of writing a work of fiction that is about Auschwitz or testimony to Auschwitz. On the other hand, Kertész himself, when we asked him about this, said all works about the Holocaust are works of fiction. He didn't mean the Holocaust doesn't exist. He just meant that any account of it, even the most autobiographical, such as those by Carlo Levi or by Wiesel himself, are putting together, they're making a story out of events which involve leaving some things out and putting some other things in. And there's no doubt that fatelessness bears a very close relation to Kertész's own experience at Auschwitz and Buchenwald and Zeitz. It's not identical, but it's close to the experience that he had. So it's a kind of, now, the notion of testimony is another theoretical issue. One has to distinguish, and it's for me an important distinction that I learned from Derek Haas' seminars at Irvine, where he talked about this topic. But testimony is not quite the same thing as factual history, because testimony always involves some kind of speech act. It involves me saying, I swear, this is what I saw. So in a court of law, where you're called as a witness, you say, this is what I saw. I swear, this is what I saw. And you might be mistaken. What's not in question is the fact that you've sworn that you're telling the truth about what you saw. So you have distinguished, and you might have seen things wrongly. You might be entirely honest in your testimony, but you might have made a mistake in what you said. So the jury in a court case doesn't have to say, this was the truth. It just means they just have to decide beyond the shadow of a doubt that the testimony that they've heard is true. So that's you can't not take that into account when you ask the question about whether novels can be valid testimony to Auschwitz. And I want to claim that it can be valid testimony. And I have some help for that from people like Nancy. There's a little essay by Nancy about representation who claims this is the case. But it's still controversial. It's not implausible for somebody to say, well, if it's a work of fiction, it will fall into the hands of the Holocaust deniers who say it's just all a work of fiction anyway, the Holocaust didn't really happen. Or it will, if it's a work of fiction, it will in some way be invented, not true to what happened. And this is related to the general question of whether it's possible to represent the Holocaust in any way. There are people who say it was so unspeakable, so awful, that there's no way to talk about it at all. It was unspeakable in a kind of, let's say, sacred way. I think that's dangerous, because my view is that the most important thing is to get all the information we can and not to forget about it. The danger is that we would just put it out of our minds, particularly for people in the United States who were in a way so distant from it. I can remember still, I'm old enough to remember how surprised I was and everybody else was when they, the Allies liberated the concentration camps. And there were a lot of horrible pictures of corpses of people almost at the dead of starvation in Life magazine. And my memory is, I was in my teens at that point, my memory is that this was really the first time that it sort of come through to me that this was going on in Germany and Poland and Czechoslovakia and so on. So that issue is one of the ones that I try to confront, and I think it's a very difficult question of whether fiction can testify to Auschwitz or to slavery in the Morrison novel, or in the case of Kafka's novels, whether fiction can testify to what it was like in Prague, where he grew up, to grow up as a Jew on the edge of the rise of Nazism. Because there's no doubt that Kafka's great novels are works of fiction, but they bear some relation to what the pre-Nazi Czechoslovakia bureaucracy and anti-Semitism were like. So they're great novels from that point of view. The final issue that concerns me in the book, that was in my mind, and I talk about all of these things, as you know, if you've read the book, is the resonances among these various forms of literature. Kafka, writing in the period in the teens and early 20s of the 20th century in Prague and Czechoslovakia, the Holocaust novels, which are written after Auschwitz, and our attempts to come to terms with it, whether it's Spiegelman's wonderful Mouse book, comics book, or McEwen's Black Dogs, or Schindler's List. Keneally, by the way, is a friend of mine. He was a colleague at Irvine, and I owe him a lot. I'm a hat fetishist, and Keneally was an Australian and went back to Australia. He left Irvine to go back to support the Free Australia movement. Keneally came back from Australia one time with a wonderful Cuba Australian sort of cowboy hat, which I greatly value. Carried it on the airplane. And, you know, it was a wonderful gift. So my question is, what happens? This is sort of a third question that was in my mind. What happens when you set these, when you set Kafka's novels next to the Holocaust novels next to Morrison's Beloved? How are they in resonance, or help you understand recent European and American history? And that's the part of it that I was very careful in what I said, but it is a part that makes me still a little uncomfortable, claiming kind of resonance among these, that somehow American slavery was like the Holocaust. That was like what it would have been like to live in Prague before the rise of the Nazis. And I carefully say they are not identical. They're very different. There's nothing like the Holocaust. And Holocaust specialists make a big point of saying that, but you can't say it's like any other mass killing. What's specific about it is it's the first great genocide that was total. I mean, the Germans wanted to kill every last Jew within their control. And secondly, it was a result of, for the first time, of bureaucratic efficiency and the use of modern technology in the crematoria and in the gas chambers. And that's special. Even more recent genocides like that in Rwanda or other places are not really quite like the German one. The fact that the German one was perpetrated by citizens of a country that was the or country or German-speaking area generally, including Austria and other places where German was the main language, the place that not only Kafka came from, who was a great German writer from Czechoslovakia, but think of it, Beethoven, Wittgenstein, Kant, Hegel, one of the great glories of Western civilization. And if I really had to choose between the importance of German Romanticism, including poets like Hölderlin, and great philosophers like Kant, Hegel, and Fichte, and so on, as against even English Romanticism, Coleridge, and Wordsworth, and Keats, and Shelley, and so on, I'm afraid I would have to say the German one is more important than relatively few Americans. That's not to take anything away from Keats and Shelley, but that's a very great high watermark of Western civilization. And that's the place where the Holocaust took place, so that's something you really take some thinking about to take advantage of. So I have, since I wrote this book, I have a term that I've invented, which would be the term anachronistic reading. I was brought up to believe that if you wanted to understand Kafka, the way to do that would be to place him as fully and completely as you could back in the culture that he came from, namely Prague and Berlin and other cities where he also lived, but primarily Prague and Czechoslovakia in the early 20th century. Just as to understand Shakespeare, you have to learn the Elizabethan frame of mind. And as against that, with all respect for the idea you should know as much as possible about the historical context of author you're studying, there's a part of me that's saying, why should I now, in 2012, care all that much about Prague in 1915? I want to know why it's important for me now to read Kafka, why it will be useful for me and helpful to me. And I'm not ashamed of saying that that ought to be the question. Just as you might say, if fourth or fifth, I've lost track now of my concerns in this book, is the question of the use of reading literature at all in these days. And you mentioned the references to Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay and the Bush administration and so on. So it's already dated. It's well as 2010. A lot of changes have taken place since then. But I think it's a mistake to say that we should just use the historical imagination. I think the real question is, why read literature and particular works of literature now? And one of the ways that functions in the book is the claim I make that Kafka's work, without Kafka exactly being aware of it, is amazingly a kind of prophecy of the Holocaust. Not only the conditions under which Jews were going to live under Nazism, which was already foreshadowed in Prague in the decades before, before the Nazis and the Second World War. But also, in the specific way, which I found quite amazing, in which the least well-known and talked about, written about, of Kafka's great novels, the one that's normally called America, though his name for it was Der Verschollene, which means the disappeared one, which is about a young man who's got a serving maid pregnant and has been sent by his family to the United States, to America, to find a job. He has an uncle here, like so many immigrants into the United States. He's supposed to find a job and a place for himself and so on. The novel ends with an amazing sequence in which the hero, Carl Rossmann, sees posters on the sidewalk promising jobs in Oklahoma, and is led to go to the place where he's given a job, sent by train. The novel, none of these three novels is finished. The latest fragment has him on the train on the way to Oklahoma. And what's really chilling about this is its close correspondence to what it was actually like, let's say, for Imre Kertész in Hungary, when the Nazis who occupied the place and the local soldiers and police who were collaborating with them promised Hungarian Jews a job, a nice place to live, and so on, and enticed them to get on the trains that were taking them straight to Auschwitz. So this would be a way in which it's impossible now to read Kafka's America without thinking of a very strange way. It's strange because how did Kafka know, in which it anticipates what was actually going to happen historically in Prague and in other parts of the Nazi Empire. And that's indeed, there are films of the Jews sort of being hurried through the streets to the train, and they were promised that they would be at a job, a place to live, they could take their families and so on. And it seems crazy now, but many of them apparently didn't know until the last moment that they were about to be killed. There are some very moving photographs, which I mentioned, the families, because the gas chambers were full, they had to wait in the woods for a while before they could actually be killed, and they look perfectly relaxed and normal because they still think things are going to be just dandy. And that's what's promised to Carl Rossmann in what is Kafka's editor and friend Max Brod called the Nature Theater of Oklahoma. Kafka never used that term. So that idea of anachronistic reading, where you read a work in the light of history that came afterwards, is another important question. It's not an answer, it's just a way of asking myself, what happens if you say, well, I'll read these novels in the light of my own situation now? And that explains or justifies the references to Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay and so on. The other thing that justifies it, if you can say it's a justification, is what you began by saying, that it does mark a real change in my own personal attitude, where I began to be anxious enough about what's going on in the United States to feel that I shouldn't just stand in the sidelines, but that I should ask myself how reading literature might help us to come to terms with that. And I've, since finishing this book, I've written quite a bit more along those lines.
Hmm.
So,
well, going back to Kafka for just a moment, obviously his work was really important to you in this book. You spent quite a bit of time talking about Kafka and the trial, the castle.
Yep. Yep.
And I found it really fascinating, and you touched on this a little bit, about how Kafka's writing was proleptic in a way, predicted the Holocaust. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that. I got chills down my spine reading some of the sections in your book about how Kafka, you almost got the sense that Kafka had the feeling that his work would become performative, would act out the Holocaust if he had finished reading or writing.
Yes, I know, and I do try to talk about that. It's one explanation for why Kafka wanted Max Brod to destroy all his manuscripts. It was as if Kafka had what you think of as a kind of superstitious fear that the things that he was writing about in his novels and stories would actually come true. So that they had a kind of prophetic power to bring about the thing they talked about, or one could say a speech act power, a performative power.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's hard to know why he wanted the works destroyed. But there's some things he said that sound a little bit like that's what he feared. So that he had the feeling, think of it, here was this very great writer. I mean, those novels, the stories are fantastic works of genius, who thought that these works were dangerous, and that they, not because they were untrue, but because they might come true. Therefore, he very strictly enjoined Brod, who was a good friend of his, to destroy them all, destroy all the manuscripts. Luckily for the world, I think, Brod didn't do that. And so when I read that, there are other Kafka scholars who've talked about this aspect of Kafka's attitude toward his own writing, I began to ask myself, well, what is it in his work that might have seemed prophetic in that way? And though that's easier to see for the America, for the disappeared one, that's very ominous. What he really wanted to call it was the disappeared one, which would suggest that when Carl Rossmann gets on that train, the very end of the disappeared one is a really magical description of Carl Rossmann. He's on the train with the other people, as they think, on the way to the Nature Theater of Oklahoma, where they'll have a job and a home, where everything will be just wonderful. It's a description of the mountains, completely imaginary. Kafka didn't know very much about the United States. Waterfalls right outside the window in the mountains. The only time I've ever experienced that myself was the first time I went to Switzerland. I was in Italy and took the train over the Alps into Switzerland. And indeed, you looked out the window and there were these waterfalls right by in the middle of the mountains, coming down the side of the rocks and so on. So that passage at the end of the disappeared one. But it suggests that he's going to disappear. Why else did he call it that? Because while he's still in New York, he hasn't disappeared. But the other two novels, in different ways, can be taken as descriptions of what it was like, what it was going to be like under the Nazi rule. The trial, as everybody knows, is about someone who is arrested one fine day. That's the first sentence, though he hadn't done anything really wrong at Das Böse, and who then spends all his time, more and more of his time, trying to prove his innocence, and is eventually executed in a very haphazard kind of way. That's the sort of thing that happened in Germany, and I'm sorry to say, sometimes happens in the United States. As we know, there have been some people falsely arrested, given what we call extraordinary rendition, sent to somewhere in Europe where they're tortured, and eventually, after two, and imprisoned, and eventually, after several years, simply dropped by the roadside somewhere where they decided that they really were not guilty of anything after all. So it's not that the events in the trial couldn't possibly happen here. And that makes me very anxious, the fact that it's not legal to arrest and hold without trial American citizens, not just presumed terrorists from another country. The suspension of habeas corpus, which is a very important part of our freedom, which means the requirement that you can arrest anybody, but you have to bring them to trial in a reasonable time. That's what habeas corpus means. And to abrogate that is very dangerous, I think. And the trial shows you what such a situation would be like. And the castle is equally powerful, in some ways the most finished of the lot. In the case of the trial, as you know, if you've read that section of my book, it's unfinished in the sense that there are an endless series of chapters and chapter fragments that show Joseph K. trying to deal with his situation of being arrested, but not really arrested, arrested, but being allowed not to be in prison, allowed to fight his own legal battle. Then the whole thing, he did, in that case, he wrote the ending of the novel, which is the execution of Joseph K., but not the chapters in between. So that execution would apparently be at the end of a, who knows how many months more of chapters like the ones that we do have. In the case of the castle, it's, again, a very haunting story of someone who comes into a village at nightfall and with the claim that he has a job there as a land surveyor. And in this case, he spends the entire novel, episode after episode, trying to get hold of the authorities in the castle to acknowledge that he has been hired. So it's a novel about the relationship between one's sense of selfhood and having a job. And again, in our country today, there's so many people without jobs that it's hard to imagine, if you've not been in that situation of being unemployed or underemployed, how closely related that is to your own sense of your value and identity as a person. It's easy to say, what good am I? Who am I? How am I anybody if I'm not valuable enough to have a job? And we now have at least 8.3% of our population is actually much higher than that, who don't have jobs. And I know this from my own family experience, because our son Matthew, who lives on the island of Kauai, has been at various times a school teacher. He still has one of those part-time jobs, which depends from year to year and how many classes there are. It's very insecure, and I've seen how difficult that is for him. So the castle helps understand that. There's another aspect of the castle which, if you've read the chapter, you'll know was important for me. And that is the way in which so much of what happens to the hero has to do with the interpretation of documents. It's a novel really about bureaucracy. And the difficulty, and indeed possibility, of getting documents, letters, etc., being sure that you've understood them correctly. And it's certainly true that in any large organized country like the United States now, a lot of time is spent worrying about documents, filling out income taxes, census forms, all the rest of it. I've just been doing a visa application for another visit to China that I'm supposed to make in September. And I've discovered that they've changed the rules, and they're now very complicated requirements for the letter of invitation that they have to write, which has all sorts of information, including in the letter of invitation, not only my name, but my age, birth date, and gender. We hereby invite J. Lewis Miller, born March 5, 1928, male, which seems very strange, because elsewhere in the documents that I send, there's all sorts of information about who I am. So I've been confronting for the last couple of days the difficulty of interpreting documents. The other topic that really interests me in the book as a whole, and is an important part of the chapter on the castle, is the question of the relation to of community, belonging to a community or not belonging to a community, to understanding other people. And that comes up, the question of what Kafka called Mitzvah, being with other people, in the first theoretical chapter, but I think it's a practical question in the castle, where the fact that that the hero does not belong to a community, and the fact that it really isn't a community because it's so hierarchical. There's the castle up there on the top of the hill with all of these mysterious officials, and then there are the people in the village, and it doesn't really form a unified community such as one would like to have. And at that point, I thought of Raymond Williams's work on community, in which he very powerfully claims that the little towns on the Welsh border, such as he grew up in, were a real community because everybody knew everybody, and that this community was jeopardized, indeed in the end destroyed, by the moving in of people from the outside who built big houses there, became squires who were usually English, and even, according to him, by the Church of England, which was the established church in England, and would be quite different from the little Baptist churches that these people went to. And that sort of stuck in my mind as corresponding to the situation in the castle. And in any case, it's a kind of ask yourself the question, it's a kind of rule in the castle that people don't have insight into what, sort of spontaneous insight into what the other person is thinking. That the lack of community means a difficulty or even failure in understanding other people. That's an anxious-making situation. So interpretation means not just interpretation of all those documents, like the ones that fill up the offices of one of the officers of the castle, Kafka, Hero, and Connors, but also the question of interpreting other people. What do their facial expressions mean? What do they really mean by what they say? Etc., what's in general called intersubjectivity. And modern literature, beginning with Kafka and such people, even for Virginia Woolf or Conrad, differs from Victorian fiction in the increasing difficulty that people in modern and postmodern literature have in getting right what the other person is thinking. Whereas in Trollope's novels, one reason I admire Trollope's novels and enjoy reading them so much, Trollope's novels presuppose that everybody in the novel belongs to the same culture. For example, in the Barset novels, belong to a village, small town that has a cathedral. Many of the people in the town are some form of minister for the cathedral, and they all know what the other person is thinking. Trollope is quite specific about that. There's a kind of transparency among the people from one consciousness to another. The idea that it's difficult to understand other people is not new in the 20th century, however. If you think about the novels of Jane Austen or George Eliot, they are about young women who are very intelligent and sensitive and sympathetic, that's a big word for George Eliot, but who nevertheless make huge mistakes about other people, especially the people that they choose to marry, or in the case of Pride and Prejudice, in the end, happily marry. But the era Elizabeth Bennet's prejudice is against Darcy. She thinks he's a terrible man, and in the end, she was wrong. So she doesn't have transparent insight to what he's like. And Dorothea in George Eliot's Middlemarch makes a huge mistake about Casaubon, whom she marries. She thinks he's like Pascal or other great 17th century writers, Milton. But marrying him would be like marrying Milton before his blindness came on, and this is shown to be a big mistake. Casaubon is not like those people. The whole novel is about the question of how she escapes from this radical mistake about other people. So that whole question of how well we understand other people and how that's related to whether we live together in a community is an important theme in this book for me.
I found that really interesting, and I think that you quote, I think it's Derrida who said, there are no worlds, there are only islands.
Right.
And I thought that was so eloquent. I don't know, like at the end of the book, I mean, you tackle these huge themes, but I feel like there's something really sort of personal and almost in a way kind of sad, that issue about knowing others.
That's right.
The limitations that we have in knowing the other, like you talk about Austin, J.L. Austin.
Yes.
And I was reminded of his essay, Knowing Others. I'm not sure, in the Philosophical Papers.
Yes.
And I thought that there was a huge connection. I mean, obviously talk about how to do things with words, but that whole issue of knowing others, I just thought was really fascinating, especially when you think about it in terms of these events like the Holocaust. And
That's very astute of you, because as it's not an obvious theme in how to do things with words, but the essay you refer to is part of a whole string of essays written in, by the Oxford people, common language people, that was precisely on that question, how do we know another person?
Mm-hmm.
So that it's not unrelated to Austin's idea, which is crucial for me, and does get into this book, at least indirectly, because I've written a whole book called Speech Acts in Literature, which is about just about that question. But Austin implicitly, for a speech act, a promise, or a warning, or any of the other standard speech acts, for it to be what he called felicitous, for it really to work, you have to have a whole set of institutions, and you have to have at least implicitly the fact that people understand one another. So that when I say, I promise to be ready at 4 o'clock on Friday to participate in this interview, you have to know what I mean by that, and we have to trust one another enough so that I really do fulfill my promise. So that Austin is right, I think, that the that felicitous is a harmless word for this, that a felicitous speech act depends on a common set of assumptions that at least implicitly suggests that we understand one another. But another of Austin's essays, which I found typically very funny and powerful, is the one about how you know whether another person is angry. The first couple of pages of that essay, he's answering somebody who's one of the people in that common language school who's raised this question, which is one of the questions that you referred to a few minutes ago. And it's a big question. How do I know what the other person is feeling? How do I know? Is it just when he says I'm angry, or she? Is that enough? Not necessarily. You might say, I'm really very angry, and not really mean it. And so it's the difficulty of intuiting what the other person's emotions are in that case. And Austin, typically, for me, Austin's one of my great heroes. He was so smart and so funny. He says, well, does somebody have to, for example, bite the rug? I'd say I'm really angry. I'm angry enough to bite the rug. Chew the edge of the rug. And then you say, I know he's really angry because he bit a hole out of the rug. So the question is, what sort of external manifestations are there? And it, indeed, for me, to get back for a moment to Derrida, for me, that is a big problem, to try to imagine what it would feel like to be somebody else and whether the emotions that I feel when I say I'm happy or angry or anxious are at all like the emotions that somebody else feels when they say the same thing. And the problem is, it's a philosophical problem, not only in the Oxford people, but also in closer one phenomenology, is that you have no direct access. That's why there's a lot of work recently in cognitive science where people try to put electrodes and try to find out what goes on in the brain when somebody is angry or anxious or elated or whatever. So that passage in Derrida, which is, for me, is a very powerful passage, and was in the last seminar that he wrote, which he did not live to give at Irvine. I used to attend his seminars every year, and after he started using the computer, at first I would ask Derrida, when I couldn't attend one of his seminars because I was away lecturing or something, could I please have a copy of the lecture that I missed, because he wrote his seminars all down. And then along about 1991 or 2 or something, using the computer, he would give me at the end of the seminars a disc. So I have a bunch of those discs of the seminars.
Oh, wow.
Any that are not published. But the last time I saw him, he had to break off the seminars and go back to Paris, I think because he was aware that there was something really serious wrong with him.
Hmm.
Was the pancreatic cancer that killed him a couple of years later. He gave me the seminars that he'd only begun giving, which are The Beast and the Sovereign 2. And it's about Heidegger. It's always Heidegger. Defoe, Robinson Crusoe. And it's apropos of Robinson Crusoe and Robinson Crusoe's Island, but suddenly in the middle of one of those seminars, you get that passage that I quote, which is a kind of very intransigent refusal to believe that there's any way you can know what the other person is thinking, and a kind of commitment on Derrida's part at the very end of his life to a kind of solitude, as like Robinson Crusoe's on his island, with no connection, no isthmus, no transfer, no bridge, no connection to another consciousness. It's a very powerful and passage that I would like to be able just to reject. Gee, it can't be all that bad. We can't be that isolated. So my hero is Alfred E. Newman, the Mad Magazine hero. What we worry. Here, and it's true, there's a kind of cheerfulness that I have that makes me better able than some other people might be to deal with things that are difficult, like Kafka's novels. Mm-hmm. My world is something like Kafka's novels, but not really. So that makes me more, and not really like Derrida's life either. Derrida really did have a reasons to be aware of his solitude as a North African Jew, an outsider, who was trying to make his way in the French intellectual system, who was chosen to be a professor by the great Paul Ricoeur. Ricoeur wanted him to be his Ricoeur's successor as the professor of one of the branches of the University of Paris. And there was so much hostility to this that they got around this by abolishing the chair. So Derrida was never a professor in France. Think of that.
Wow.
He was a maître de conférence, de conférence at the École des Hautes Études, and he taught for years and years at the École Normale. So it wasn't that he had a position, but it would be technically a much lower position than to be a professor. So that he suffered not only during the Nazi period, when in North Africa he was thrown out of the school he went to because he was Jewish, but also later on in the hostility to him in the French system. Not that they were not good to him. He did get into the École Normale, which is the elite sort of high. It would correspond in the United States to sort of the last 2 years of high school and the first 2 years of college. It's sort of halfway between a college and a high school. He got into the important one where all the great French intellectuals went, and he did very well there. He tells a story about, and his work was recognized and admired in France, but he tells a story about his great teacher, Jean Hippolyte, who was also, by the way, at that Hopkins conference. Hippolyte, who would have been his director of studies, whatever you would call that, who said to him, Jacques, I'm not quite sure where your work is going. And Derrida answered, I don't know either. If I knew already, I wouldn't want to go there. So there was a genuine degree of improvisation in Derrida's work. But there would be a lot more to say about Derrida. Anderson. Obliquely into this book.
Well, Dr. Miller, we've taken up a lot of your time. As a way to sort of conclude, I was wondering if maybe you'd like to talk a little bit about any projects you're currently working on.
Yes. Well, since I published this book, I published two other books. One of them, a book about George Eliot, primarily but not exclusively about Middlemarch. And it brings up some of the same issues we've been talking about. There's a section on Phileas Adam Bede, but that shows that little book, which was published quite recently by Edinburgh Press, shows my continued allegiance to Victorian literature, which is what I originally was. And the other book is written with Tom Collin and Claire Colebrook. Tom Collin was a student at Yale whom I've known forever and ever. He was really a student of Paul Denand's, but after Denand's death, I had just finished directing the dissertation. And this is a book called Theory in the Disappearing Future, which is really about the state of theory and the usefulness of theory, primarily literary theory. And in the case of this little book, it's again a small book, Paul Denand's work. So this is a book about Paul Denand, and in particular about the essay by Denand written right at the end of his life on Walter Benjamin's The Task of the Translator. It was not an essay that he really published, but gave as a lecture twice. Wonderful lecture, wonderfully challenging lecture, reading of Benjamin's essay on the Aufgabe des Übersetzers, the Task of the Translator. It was given at Yale at the Whitney Humanities Center, and I heard that version of it. And then it was given at Cornell, where it was taped, and the published version of the essay comes from the tape made at the Cornell version. So I thought it was a wonderful lecture that he gave at Yale, in spite of the fact that there was the man had a great gift for sending people up the wall, making them very anxious. That certainly happened with this lecture, because there were people there who had the vested interest in a quite different way of reading Walter Benjamin, who protested against the lecture. And the same thing happened again at Cornell, where the people didn't just say, oh, this is wonderful. So I thought in the spring, or maybe the summer, he died the next December of 1983, this would have been. I used to visit the man at his house once a week, and to see how he was doing, and they would give me a glass of sherry, and Paul and I would talk, and so on. I said, I wonder if you could give me the manuscript of that lecture about Benjamin. He said, I don't have a manuscript. I never wrote it out. All I have is some notes in a notebook. He said, you can probably reconstruct the essay from those notes. So he gave me that notebook, which has, well, the two versions of the notes. One of them, the long one, which nobody had ever done anything with, is about 11 pages. So, but it's not a written out seminar. And that, in that way, Denand and Derrida were very different. Derrida always had his seminars completely written out in French. Denand never did. All he had was a few little quotations and a few little ideas, and he would give a two-hour seminar completely improvised on the basis of these notes. These notes are a little fuller for the Benjamin lecture. So our little book is has a transcript of those 11 pages of notes and essays by the three of us trying to worry not just about the man, but about theory these days. So that's the second book. And then there are other things that would be too a long story to tell. One of the various things that I've had to write recently, I've written, when I go to China, people want me to write lectures on subjects like, or China, or often from friends here and there who want me to write something for an issue of a magazine. It's on subjects like, does literature matter? Why read literature? So I had a bunch of those, and planning a book with a colleague whom I've never met, but who contributed to special issues of magazines that he does, a professor at North Bengal University called Ranjan Ghosh, G-H-O-S-H. And we're planning a collaborative book in which I'll have three essays, including the one about what does literature matter, and one about a serious question these days about globalization of literature study and the development of the discipline of world literature, which I've attended conferences, one in Shanghai not long ago, and wrote a paper about, you know, what about world literature. So in a way, I prefer to write about particular works of literature. For example, I have written recently something about McEwan's Atonement and the film, and that, in a way, interests me more. So my real interest still is in works of literature, and I'm always made a little uncomfortable by people saying, we don't want you to talk about a particular work of literature, nobody will read it. Tell us about what you think about the future of literary study. So that's the little battle that I'm fighting. I've written recently something that I did enjoy writing, which was for there's a magazine called Glossator, which is committed to glosses. There's an issue in which people are supposed to write something glossing some part of Derrida's The Postcard. So I have written, I said, well, okay, I'll do this. And because the first part of The Postcard, the au revoir part, strikes me as, among other things, a brilliant postmodern novel. It really is a novel in letters. So I found a lot to say about that, and that was done this summer. It's particularly interesting because, on the one hand, it's a work of fiction, very mysterious, you know, who he's writing to, or who the person writing the letters is, etc. It's entirely up to letters. On the other hand, there are a lot of things in there which I know to be factual because they involve me. There are four places where I appear in that book. One of them is Hillis took me sailing on Long Island Sound the other day, and indeed I did take Derrida sailing in those days. I kept the Typhoon, the Frippery, in Brantford Harbor near New Haven. What Derrida didn't know was that the small craft warnings were up. It wasn't too bad. It wasn't really blowing a gale, but technically there was a little too much wind. Nothing happened. It was perfectly safe. But I didn't say shock. I'm not sure we should be out today. All craft warnings are up. And another episode that he mentions was, I was teaching in Zurich, and Derrida came to give a lecture in Zurich. And he was working on The Postcard, and particularly the au revoir part, which has to do, he was fascinated by changes in modes of telecommunication over the centuries. For example, trying to imagine what psychoanalysis would have been if it hadn't been developed at a time when you had to write letters and send them and use the telephone. So the technological devices available were the telephone and the postal service. So he says, what would psychoanalysis have been like if Freud and his colleagues had email and MCI, et cetera? Now we would say iPads and iPhones and Skype. But he was writing before that those things were really available. At any rate, he came to Zurich, and we went together up to the Zoo Cemetery near the zoo up on the top of the hill there, to visit the grave of James Joyce, for whom both of us have some piety. The influence on Derrida's work of Hennigan's Wake is considerable. So we went way in the back of the cemetery. I knew where he was, and there was this little stanza, very charming, sort of half-sized statue of Joyce with his cane. And if I remember correctly, a cigarette in his hand. It's all looking very Joycean. So we paid our respects to that. But when we came back down through a slightly different route to get, we were looking for the tomb of a professor that we both knew who killed himself, Peter Zundi. And I know he's there because I'd seen the tomb, but we couldn't find him. What we did find was the tomb of somebody named Egon Zoller, a very Swiss name, who was, I'll translate it, but the German is very good, Das Erfinder des Telefonographen, which, as far as I could tell, that the inventor of the ticker tape, because on his tomb was carved a ticker tape machine with ticker tape going across from Alpha to Omega. And Derrida thought this was absolutely amazing. Remember, he's interested in modes of communication at this point. And we stood for 10 minutes or 15 minutes or 20 minutes in front of the tomb of Egon Zoller. And that's in the postcard. And it really did happen. So on the one hand, it's sort of like my Holocaust novels. It's a work of fiction. On the other hand, it has some things in it which really happened, and that I know happened, or at any rate, I can testify. I give my testimony. I swear this really happened. So that's what I'm doing these days.
Okay, well, Dr. Miller, it's been really, really great talking to you, and I thank you so much for speaking with us. Well, I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you join me next time when my guest will be Ulrich Plaas, and we'll be discussing his book, Language and History, in Theodore W. Adorno's Notes to Literature.